That's pretty squishy mud.
You're loud, right?
Sure.
You want to get a taste of a very different attitude toward rain? Well, just hang out with a 4- and a 6-year-old for a little while.
To get as okay as you
dirty as yucky as you can get.
These happen to be my 4- and 6-year-olds. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. So this week, we're talking about rain, and maybe trying to think in some different ways about it.
Mud world.
Yeah. A water park. But instead of water, it's mud. And then everybody gets so muddy.
And yeah, I know this gets exaggerated, and Seattle really doesn't have as much rain as even New York or Washington, D.C. or whatever, but let's get real. Rain is part of life in the Northwest in a way it just isn't in a lot of other places. So today, we're going to meet some people who embrace the rain, though probably not quite as much as Ezra and Oliver do here.
We could both get me to the sand and crack it into a mud ball and throw it in the water. Yay, I scored a mud ball. And this is made of real mud.
Those guys will be back a little bit later in the show when we'll travel to the rainiest place in the lower 48 states. But first, it's time to meet some friends and get caught up on the week's news. So stick around for that, plus a very rainy sound effect right here on KPLU. We've asked some friends to join us today to catch us up on the week's news. I am joined now by Nina Shapiro, senior editor at Seattle Weekly, Barrett Anderson, managing editor at Crosscut.com, and Peter Robison, who is the Seattle Bureau Chief for Bloomberg. Thank you guys for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So we're here to talk about the top story of the week, but also to make our nominations for Overcovered Story of the Week and our choice for Undercovered Story of the Week. Barrett Anderson, maybe you could kind of get us underway.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the big, big story this week was really the Seahawks win on Sunday. The really fascinating thing about that game was not the fact that the Seahawks won. They've won a lot of games. But it was a magnifying glass onto this team's strength in both finishing things in the fourth quarter, but also the amount that they really believe in themselves. I mean, they prove that even when they're down, Russell Wilson is able to keep that team together and to motivate them to not give up and to keep giving it their all.
Peter Robison, do you agree? Do you think that that was the top story of the week?
I think it's just taken on a life of its own beyond football. Everyone on the street is excited about the Seahawks. You see it on buildings. Even the building where I work, it's a very sober, lawyerly building, and they've got a 6-foot-tall Seahawks logo in the lobby. So I just think it would be churlish to say this is not the top story. Everyone is really excited about it.
Churlish. Well, I'm going to use that to pivot to Nina Shapiro, if you don't mind.
Nina Churlish Shapiro.
Are you churlish?
I am churlish. I am churlish. Yeah, I think we're going to talk about this later, but that was actually my over-reported story of the week.
And why so?
Well, it's clearly a big, big deal for a lot of people, but the number of stories, the way that reporters are milking this to get every single angle. And we're as guilty as this as anyone. I have to tell you that I walked past my editor in the hallway the other day, and he was telling somebody that we have a Seahawks food story coming up next week, so everybody can look out for
that. Is it like how to make fried Seahawks?
I have no idea. But I think it's just a great example of how newspapers are really just trying to find every possible angle. And there's a great reason for that, which is why I have some trepidation in saying that it's overreported, because, you know, it's a story that sells newspapers. This is a great, great thing for the media in a time when the media really needs as much revenue as it can get. So it's getting people to pick up the paper, and that's fantastic.
Well, that didn't seem so churlish. That seemed kind of reasonable. What do you think, Barry?
You know, Nina, I have to agree with you. You've definitely seen the media stretch itself to its limits, trying to find new angles, reporting on it. You mentioned you guys have a Seahawks food story coming out next week. We actually have a kind of funny take on a Seahawks astrology story coming out next week. So we can kind of pair those up.
Yeah, although there's some great stories that I would never have thought of that even I was fascinated in. So there was a Times story on this incredible aggressive trademark strategy that the Seahawks is doing, where they're not letting anybody else use the number 12 or the word boom. So I thought that was an example of really taking a story and making a great business kind of investigative story out of it.
It's also been very interesting for people in, say, alternative weekly newspapers or public radio or media that don't typically sort of cater to sports fans or it's not necessarily our forte, trying to figure out what some good and interesting ways to cover this story have. It's been something of a challenge this week. Peter Robinson, I don't know if you encountered a problem like that with your overreported story of the week. What was your nomination for that?
My nomination was a business story that also got wide play in the mainstream press, and it was Elon Musk's decision to open Seattle office for his satellite business. There are a lot of notable failures in this area. Teledesic is one that people might remember, and there are very few people who can get that kind of attention just from saying, I'm here. So I think he benefited from the charismatic billionaire force field.
I think that's kind of the brilliance of Elon Musk. You know, he raises these very outlandish, huge projects like the Hyperloop, building an entire company of electric cars, building a giant company of solar panels, some of which work better than others. But he generally kind of returns on what he says he's going to do. So it will be pretty fascinating, I think, to watch what he's doing in Seattle, particularly as it pertains to the space industry here. There's a lot going on with that.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, joined by Nina Shapiro, Peter Robison, and Barrett Anderson. We've been talking about our overreported stories of the week. And Nina Shapiro, maybe we could go back and catch up on your top story nominee of the week.
Yeah, so I nominated what's being dubbed middle-class economics. And of course, that's a term that came up with Obama's State of the Union speech this week. And so what the president did is he is proposing increasing taxes on the rich, such as the capital gains tax, and creating new programs like free college, free community college, and also childcare subsidies. And what's really interesting is the way that story has resonated locally. So there have been a series of local spinoffs, and that's because there have been some parallels with what's happening locally as well. So this week, Governor Jay Inslee proposed a capital gains tax of his own. This would be the first capital gains tax in Washington state. Washington state, of course, having no income tax either, being one of the few states that does that. So this kind of gets us a little bit there. It's a modest capital gains tax. It's only 7%. But at the same time, it's going to shape up to be a big battle, because one of the first things that the state Senate did was pass a bill that requires a two-thirds vote for any new tax. So this has already kind of reached the stage of rhetoric. The D's are calling it the Billionaire Protection Act. So it's going to be a very vehement battle in the legislature this season.
All right. Top story, middle-class economics and taxes. I have a feeling we're going to be talking a lot about that during this legislative session.
Yeah.
So, distinguished panelists, what are your nominees for the most underreported story of the week? What is a story that you think ought to be getting a little more attention than it has been? Peter Robison, maybe we could start with you.
There was a listeria outbreak that killed one person and two others were hospitalized, and it was in Queso Fresco, which if you've been pregnant or your wife has, you've probably been in a restaurant and you've asked them to hold the Queso Fresco, not imagining that anything would happen. But it's a shame that Americans get sick from their food so often that it's no longer a big story.
Yeah, I have to say that the soft cheese thing, if you're pregnant, you're not supposed to eat soft cheese, is one of these things that kind of gets a little bit mocked because it seems so alarmist. But then once in a while, you get these outbreaks that can be very, very serious for a pregnant person and for other people as well. And this is, our third or fourth listeria outbreak in the last couple of months?
Yeah, but there was also caramel apples and ice cream.
Listeria outbreak, your undercovered story of the week. Barrett Anderson, what's your nominee for undercovered of the week?
I really think that the biggest story that no one is talking about, and this kind of goes beyond the week, really, but the fact that the legislature is facing two of the most huge hurdles in terms of funding, both in funding a transportation package and funding an education package. And yet the way that the legislature is structured and the way that economic reports and all of this are timed, it's not something that they're really going to tackle until the end of the session, right? So here we are in Washington state with an education system that is really in trouble. They don't have enough money to operate in a way that really benefits our children. And the legislators are sitting around not by their own fault, but because of the way that the legislative session is structured and timing is structured, and working on other things. Other things that are maybe important, yes, but I don't think anyone could argue that they're more important than being able to educate our children and get around our state. And I think that is really one thing that hasn't really necessarily been called out a lot in the press.
These two big elephants in the room that they're not even going to look at for quite a while.
And it's an antiquated system. I think there are a lot of reforms that could be made that would help legislators, A, work together better, and B, get things done in a timely manner.
All right, that's Barrett Anderson's undercovered story of the week, the transportation and education log jams in Olympia. Nina Shapiro, what are your thoughts on the undercovered of the week?
Well, so I thought one of the most interesting lines in President Obama's speech was the line he had about childcare, which was, this is not a side issue, this is not a woman's issue. And I absolutely agree with him, but I think that that was an aspirational thought rather than a reality. I think that is exactly how it's seen, as a side issue and a woman's issue that the press really don't take seriously. They don't dig into. There are a million stories that can be done. And locally, we kind of have a little toehold in that issue with the universal pre-K initiatives that happened here and the debate. But what was really interesting was that this debate was not covered as a child care issue. It was covered as a education issue, and that was very deliberate on the part of the politicians. You know, I interviewed Tim Burgess, the council member, when I was doing a story about how the minimum wage increase would affect child care costs, which I think it would quite a lot. And so I was talking to him about the pre-K initiative, which he spearheaded. And he was very careful in saying, this is not a child care initiative. I'm not prepared to talk about child care right now. And that's because of the way that that issue is viewed. I think he knows that it would be dead in the water, that a lot of people don't think this is an issue that really we need to tackle.
Well, three great choices for undercovered stories of the week from our panelists here. Now, we're going to change gears for a moment because we are thinking a little bit about rain as we move into the rest of this week's show and maybe some contrarian takes on rain. Dare I say churlish takes here and there on rain. And I was sort of surprised when I moved here a few years ago how often people still complain about the rain. I mean, people in Seattle complaining about the rain, it just felt like, why didn't you know what you were getting into? But and then I sort of came to understand it's really it's recreational complaining. It's kind of like a,
it's a bonding mechanism.
Yeah, really. It's a local sport, really. And so I was just curious where the three of you are at with rain these days. I mean, you love it, you hate it. Peter Robinson, beginning with you, rain ruin your day, make your day? What do you think?
Well, I grew up in Arizona and California, not known for rain. So it was a surprise when I moved here how often you're driving with your headlights on at noon. when I first moved here, I was talking to a long-timer who it was in the midst of a 98-day stretch of rain. And he said, well, the thing about, you know, the weather here is that you appreciate the good weather. And I thought, I am moving to San Francisco. But then, you know, the longer I've been here, I've realized that I think that's true, and that I think it's something your brain does, and you learn to overvalue the good days. So I think it's been a great winter, and it hasn't really rained that much.
Nina, do you make yourself go outside when it is raining? And if so, how do you kind of handle it?
Well, I have to go outside a lot because I have a dog. So we got a dog several years ago, and this was kind of a turning point for me because I am an umbrella fanatic, unlike Northwesterners, native Northwesterners.
Thank you. I use an umbrella, too. And I think that whole Northwesterners don't use umbrellas thing is totally wrong, actually.
Totally wrong.
And overrated.
Yeah, but I'm kind of fanatical about it in that I always have to have an umbrella in my purse, just in case. But the thing about it is, it's hard to juggle an umbrella when you're picking up dog poop. So then I made this amazing discovery, which are there are these things called waterproof jackets.
What?
And they have hoods. And you can
for your head?
Yeah. Exactly. And they actually work. So I wandered into North Face and got myself a jacket.
All right. So admitted umbrella fanatics, Nina Shapiro and Barrett Anderson. Barrett, how do you sort of handle the rain? Are you at peace with it or what?
I actually love the rain. I think if we didn't have as much rain as we do, we wouldn't be living in the beautiful, gorgeous place that we are. And it's also really the only thing keeping us from being totally overrun by outsiders. So I think it's really important that we keep up this facade of it's horrible here, you should never move here, it's really depressing.
I don't think that's working anymore.
I think the outsiders have caught on to the latest technology.
There are still people out there. I hear it a lot. You know,
cats out of the bag.
From young people who are like, well, I like Seattle, but it rains so much there. You know, I don't think I could live there.
Well, Nina Shapiro, senior editor of Seattle Weekly, Peter Robison, Seattle bureau chief for Bloomberg, and Barrett Anderson, managing editor of Crosscut. Thank you guys so much for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we are thinking about rain. And when I think about rain, when I want to know more about it, like how much and when and that kind of stuff, I turn mostly to one guy, Cliff Mass. I think I'm not alone here in waiting for his conversations every Friday here on KPLU with Bellamy Palethorpe. And I think anyone who's listened to him for a little while knows that he doesn't just work with the weather. He loves the weather. He, like, lives the weather. And we wanted to know why. What is it about meteorology that gets Cliff Mass so excited? We asked KPLU's Ed Ronco to go find out.
Cliff Mass has been teaching the weather at the University of Washington since 1981. That's longer than I've been alive. And he has very strong beliefs.
You know, weather plays a special role because I think it's sort of half science, half religion.
If weather is a naturalistic religion, then Cliff might be a deacon preaching the gospel of meteorology to the masses. But these scriptures are written in equations and processed through computers. We're standing on the roof of the Atmospheric Sciences Building where Cliff has his office.
We're about 7 floors up, and we have a beautiful view.
From here, we'd be able to see downtown Seattle, the Cascades, and Mount Rainier.
But we can't because it's foggy right now. Very frequently we come up here to look at the weather, and in fact sometimes students have gotten carried away with that. You know, one year there was a series of thunderstorms that were approaching, and they were up on the roof and their hair started going on end, which is a very bad sign. They got down immediately, but lightning hit right near here, so.
I look at the sky from here, and I see gray, and I of course see fog. As a meteorologist, do you see 1,000 more things than I'm seeing right now?
There's a context to everything that you see. Like, for instance, right now there's a strong inversion above us, temperature increasing with height. And that is acting as a cap that's keeping in a layer of cooler air that has a lot of fog and pollutants in it at low levels. So we are right now within that cold, foggy layer. But if you just went up 500 feet, 1,000 feet, you get out of it.
Cliff Mass is a weather celebrity, at least within the Puget Sound area. In addition to his weekly appearance on this station, he's regularly called upon by Seattle media to predict when a big storm is going to arrive or explain why the fog smells bad. He's been interested in weather ever since he was a little kid.
I grew up on Long Island, and so the weather is a little bit different than here. More thunderstorms, more snowstorms, and occasionally hurricanes. So, you know, a little bit more of a severe weather edge than we have here in the Northwest.
What gets you really excited about the weather?
Extreme weather, I get really excited.
Like,
you know?
Like what?
A snowstorm. Nothing gives me more pleasure than a big snowstorm and, you know, being stuck in my home and, you know, having a snow day. I also love the big windstorms.
And Cliff remembers severe weather. He remembers it the way diehard football fans know statistics from, like, 1983.
Back in December 18th, 1990, January 20th, 1993. Snow came in, and then a bunch of us got trapped. You could see the trees in front of the building tilting.
We still had power.
It was so cold.
Gusting to 88 miles per hour.
So that was very exciting.
The Inauguration Day storm.
Or the Hanukkah Eve storm.
Biggest one of all, the Columbus Day storm.
So the weather has some drama, and it has some practical considerations, too.
I can give 100 examples about how the economy and life and safety are really profoundly affected by weather.
But those all speak to why the weather is useful. Why is the weather exciting?
Weather clearly is something greater than we are, and it's particularly storms. People love storms, and I think it's a very religious sense. that you know, there is a power greater than us, and there's no better way to experience that, to be in some severe weather, strong winds, snow, you name it.
That was KPLU weather expert Cliff Mass talking to our Ed Ronco about his enthusiasm for the rain.
The sun is out, the sky is blue, there's not a cloud to spoil the view, but it's raining, raining in my heart. The weatherman says clear today, he doesn't know you've gone away, and it's raining, raining in my heart.
So if you like the weather, you're in luck, because one of the rainiest spots in the country lies just to the west of the Puget Sound. I'm talking about the Hoh Rainforest on the Olympic Peninsula, which gets something like 12 or 13 feet of rain every year. And if you've never been there, the result is otherworldly.
It has so much moss, way more moss than usual. The planet made of moss.
Those are my rugrats again, running around this real-life enchanted forest. You know, it's all towering trees and lush mats of moss and branches hung with these long draperies of green. It's wild. And it was really cool to see this rainy wonderland through a kid's eyes. Here is just a little snippet that demonstrates the power that this wet wonderland holds over a child. It even overcame my son's sweet tooth.
You know, I'm always waiting for M&M zones.
Yes.
Right now, I can wait because it's just too beautiful here.
So I got to explain that usually when we're hiking, we bribe you with M&Ms in order to get you to keep going. But today it's so nice here that you're not even thinking about the candy.
Yeah. It's so fun because there's like trees that are like perfect for me climbing.
This place is so beautiful, it's even enchanted this six-year-old.
Why are we running?
And the reason for all that is the rain. So I wanted to know how all that water shapes this landscape. And I put that question to Ranger John Preston. He's the lead interpretive officer at the Olympic National Park and a guru on the temperate rainforest.
Well, all living things need water. It is that magical solvent that transports all the nutrients we need through our bodies. It doesn't matter whether you're a tree or a salmon or a human being. Water is essential for those life processes. And it gives everybody time to just crank out some impressive growth rates, creating an ecosystem that has the highest biomass in the world, highest mass of living and previously living matter. It is densely packed with vegetation, and the vegetation reaches proportions that are awe-inspiring and humbling. Like that Sitka spruce we were just looking at. Just massive trees that grow rapidly. This forest beats all forests on the planet in terms of surface area. Every thread of moss is a surface on which some animal can live. And every layer of moss is packed with them. And they live upon the backs of their dead ancestors. It creates arboreal soil at the base of the moss layer. The trees, instead of just putting roots out into the ground, put roots out into the moss layer and derive nutrients from that, because nobody's going to let anything go to waste.
So let's talk about that moss for a second, because that's one of the most visually striking things when you just walk in here off the street. You know, you see all this moss hanging around and piled high, and I mean, it's just really amazing. How important is it in the ecosystem overall, and how does it make this place different than other kinds of forests?
Well, let's take a walk over here and see if we can just get our hands on a big, thick moss mat. So, smell that, Gabriel. It smells just like turning soil over on into your garden.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at this big handful of it. It is about a 40-year accumulation of moss.
Just in your, that's that in your hand. I mean, it looks like a planty wig, that what you're holding in your hand.
Right, right. It looks like a toupee. And so moss acts as a big, huge filter for raindrops. Now, raindrop coalesces around a particle of dust, a microscopic particle of dust. And when it hits this moss layer, a moss layer this thick, that water percolates down, but the dust stays. The moss filters it out. And gradually, that dust works its way to the bottom, creating a layer of mineral soil. and it gets populated by all these arthropods, tiny arthropods like mites, a lot of nematodes in here, and, you know, any number of creatures that live their entire lives in here, including a lot of tiny spiders in this forest. Mm. I mean, bazillions of them. They die here, and they are made up of potassium, phosphorus, and nitrogen, creating a layer of organic soil. And that's when the trees can really derive nutrients from it. We have this kind of song. Do you want to hear a song?
Of course I want to hear a song.
Okay. The itsy bitsy spider moved into the moss. Along came a mosquito and landed on that moss. Then the spider ran out, sunk its fangs into its secreted digestive juices and sucked its brains out. And so you have all this predation, and the stuff is, you know, all those nutrients are going down to the bottom. It becomes a whole layer of soil that doesn't exist in other forests.
So you've got this stuff over a huge percentage of this forest that is just a whole kind of envelope of life that doesn't exist in a lot of other places.
Right. If you think of other forests as kind of like these maybe double-level suburban places, this one is a metropolis of skyscrapers with, you know, multiple condos that go clear up, you know, 75 meters into the sky. I mean, it's an amazing place. All kinds of habitat, all kinds of surfaces on which to live.
So here we are in one of the wettest landscapes in North America, or at least in the lower 48, that's for sure. I just wonder how you feel about rain these days.
Well, I get phone calls. I answer the phone all the time. Questions from visitors coming out here. And they say they want to come out here when it's nice. And if you like it, shiny, clean, pristine, fresh. I don't know. January's pretty nice to me. I love the rain. I love the sound it makes. It means that one basic component of life is available to me. I'm not crawling across some dry desert looking for water. That it's close to me gives me comfort. Being around a multitude of different kinds of living things also brings me great joy and comfort. Yeah, this place has tremendous meaning to me that way. And I think that's why thousands and thousands of people come here. Maybe to experience that, get a piece of it, to taste it.
John Preston, who mans the wettest ranger station in the lower 48 here at the Hoh Rainforest, thank you for showing us around your very moist world.
Thank you, Gabriel. This is a lot of fun.
Hi, guys. What have you been doing?
Walking.
Getting wet?
Yeah.
Cool. It's Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Now imagine creating something that no one even knows is there, except for when it's raining. That is what this 21-year-old Seattle magician decided to do. His name is Peregrine Church. KPLU's Paula Whistle met up with him on Seattle's Capitol Hill on one drizzly afternoon.
Before I get to Peregrine Church's rain-related creation, a little bit about what I'll call his approach to life. He's somebody who keeps a red clown nose in his pocket. When the mood strikes, he just puts it on as he's walking downtown or riding the bus.
I just like making people smile, and so I'm happy to sacrifice looking normal for the sake of giving people something to smile about.
Church says, without a hint of cynicism, that his goal in life is to make people's lives a little brighter. Novelty is the key, he tells me, creating things or experiences that are so out of the ordinary they jar you out of your routine. Which brings us to his idea for rain-activated art. On random sidewalks around the city, Church has stenciled messages that magically appear when it rains. So tell me what this one says.
This one says, proud to be rainy, which I think is a fun message for Seattle.
So literally, when it's dry, we won't see this.
You won't see it. You can't feel it. It's just...
it's invisible.
Yeah, it's completely invisible when dry.
You're a magician.
I am a magician.
Church is actually president of the Magicians Club at the University of Washington. They do gigs for business events and such. He's no longer a student at the UW, though. He dropped out, he says, because it wasn't hands-on enough for him. I'm interviewing him in a copy shop across from Seattle Central College. Not coffee shop, mind you. A copy shop. You know, a FedEx place where you go to make copies. Through the window of the shop, we have a perfect view of the sidewalk with the aforementioned "Proud to be Rainy" message stenciled on it. When I first arrived, I asked him the obvious question.
While you've been sitting here, have you noticed anybody noticing it?
Only a couple. A lot of people are on their phones or in a hurry to cross the street. See, this girl, it's right at the edge of the sidewalk where the crosswalk is, but she's sort of walked into the street, waiting to cross the street as fast as she can.
After all, it is raining. Nobody wants to exactly linger. Church got the idea to create his rain-activated messages from a viral video promoting what are called super hydrophobic coatings that can be sprayed on anything.
The video showed these dramatic shots of, like, chocolate syrup running off these perfectly white shoes or red wine spilling off things, and all the things were perfectly untouched.
It got him thinking, what if you use that waterproof spray to write or draw something on a sidewalk? The part of the concrete you sprayed would stay dry and light-colored in the rain.
But everything else would get darker, and that contrast would create an image.
He tested it out, and it worked. In the past year, he stenciled giant raindrops and the words, "Stay dry out there," near a bus stop in West Seattle. You can see the phrase, "Worry is a misuse of the imagination," on a sidewalk in Belltown. Or one that says, "Attention, the ground is lava," then shows dry spots across a 100-foot stretch of concrete so you can jump to safety. And in the Fremont neighborhood,
there's like a lily pad pond with all these lily pads and frogs hopping between them.
Meanwhile, as we talk, he continues to stare out the window, searching for reaction to his "Proud to be Rainy" stencil.
Sorry, I'm getting really distracted by watching these people's faces.
Well, I still want you to describe what you're seeing.
Three people are waiting for the crosswalk, just sort of hands in their hips, waiting to cross. But they're mainly staring at the crosswalk symbol across the street.
Church doesn't actually like rain, but he says if you're trying to cheer people up, you can't very well do it when they're already happy.
Sunny day, like, I'll smile no matter what. I love sun. And most people in Seattle feel that way. Like, everything just seems brighter and better.
But when the clouds roll in and we kind of hunker down,
it's nice to have something that can sort of counteract that. And it's gonna rain anyway, so why not do something fun with it? That woman's gonna run over.
Still no reaction to the rainwork message here.
Oh, there we go. She's okay.
Yeah, most people seem to be focused on just getting across that street without
I mean,
car.
It's all about location. Like, my favorite place to make them is probably bus stops, because people there have nothing to do until their bus arrives.
You could say Church embodies the idealism of youth. He says he'll never use his rainworks for commercial purposes, no stenciling happy hour from 4 to 6, for example. He says we're already bombarded with too many of those sorts of messages. And if he's a guerrilla artist, he's the Boy Scout version. He makes a point of telling me the sprays he uses are non-toxic, biodegradable, and won't make the sidewalk slippery. Still, a young guy with a spray can out at night can attract suspicion. One time he had his stencil on the sidewalk, spray in hand, was just about to begin.
And then I hear this voice from behind me saying, "You are not going to do that." And I turn around and there's this woman with this appalled look on her face.
Once he convinced her that he wasn't a graffiti tagger, that he was spraying on a work of art that would only be seen when it rained,
she's like, "Oh, that's really cool. Carry on."
It does get me wondering, though, is this legal? After all, Church hasn't exactly gotten permission to do it. For the answer, I head down to the sidewalk division of Seattle's Department of Transportation, where I meet
Jennifer Wieland, and I manage our public space program.
So I ask her, is it legal?
It is, yeah, as long as it's not a commercial message.
When I tell her it's definitely not commercial, she becomes quite enthusiastic, embraces it. She says the city is working to make neighborhoods more vibrant.
Really doing things that entice people to enjoy our public space differently. So this is very much in line with the kinds of things we'd like to see.
The challenge for Church remains, of course, getting people to actually see what's right below their feet. He jokes about having one of his stenciled messages be, "Thanks for being observant." Finally, just before I'm about to leave, success.
This person sees it. Yep, she looked at it. Okay, cool. And now she's on her way.
And that makes Peregrine Church smile. Paula Whistle, KPLU.
Church created a map of his creations. You can find it, plus photos of his art, at our sister website, quirksee.org. That's quirksee.org. The map doesn't have a lot of detail, and that's on purpose, because Church really wants people to go out and discover the messages on their own. I just wish it would rain. Oh, let it rain. Rain, rain, rain.
Ooh, let it rain. Oh, yeah. Let it rain.
We are talking rain this week on Sound Effect, and of course, people all over associate Seattle with rain, but consider this. It actually rains three times more in LaPush, Washington, on the Olympic Peninsula, than it does in Seattle. The natives of that region, the Quileute Indians, have been thriving in that landscape for a really long time. It's basically a civilization that grew up in one of the wettest parts of the country.
The Quileute word for rain is sabok. Sabok.
Can you say it one more time?
Sabok.
That is Rio Jamie. He's a teacher and a tribal council member, and I met up with him earlier this winter to hear how rain has shaped his culture. And I was curious what his ancestors wore to stay dry in the many centuries before Gore-Tex. The answer? Wood.
Women wore as undergarments like a cedar bark apron that kind of went to their thigh area. And then over that, they had a cedar bark skirt that usually went just below the knees. In cold weather, they would wear capes of elk fur, bear fur, with the fur facing outwards. And in rainy times, they had like woven swamp grass ponchos that they would wear. Men oftentimes wore nothing unless in really cold weather. They would throw one of those fur capes on or one of the rain ponchos. The Quileutes had a breed of dog which was kind of a hairy, woolly dog, you know, with a hair similar to a sheep, that we were told, that they used the dog fur to weave blankets. And these blankets were really highly prized, highly sought after blankets.
The ponchos, they're woven from grass.
Yeah, swamp grass is all I know. I don't know if that's referring to like bear grass or cattails or something along those lines for...
This obviously, you know, the ancestral home of the Quileute is one of the rainiest places in the lower 48, right? How much does rain kind of figure into the culture and identity of the Quileute people?
Yeah, we are in the wettest part of the lower 48, and it's just something that it just is. We don't really think about it as being a hindrance for a lot of things. It's just the way it is. The old people, they would just kind of hang out in their longhouses and have ceremonies and tell stories and sing songs and make items, tools, repair nets. The rainy time was just a time to kind of take care of those chores.
How do you feel about rain? Does it annoy you? You okay with it? I mean, you live with it so much of the year.
You know, obviously there's those times that you just kind of look outside and say, man, it's pouring. I don't really want to have to do anything out there. But for this year, for example, our summer was a little bit drier than we were used to. You know, we had a stretch of like 30 days with no rain there. And by the time that the rain came, we were just like dancing out in the street because, you know, it felt comfortable to be, you know, in our element again, you know, and rainy season is our element.
Do you think about what life must have been like for those ancestors who, you know, couldn't go inside into insulated houses and just sort of were making their life in a pretty harsh landscape and doing the best they could with the technology that they had?
I think about it every day. When I'm coming down to work, I live in the upper part of the village, and when you're coming down to LaPush, there's a little section coming down the hill where you can look out into First Beach, and you can see James Island, and James Island is a really sacred place where our chiefs are buried. And on First Beach, there is a little creek that goes into the ocean. It's called Lonesome Creek. Every day I come down the hill, I look off to the lookout there, and I think about the old people in the old days. They were very adamant about, they had to keep their spirit strong, their tahele, it was their spirit power. So men and women both would go and bathe every day in this creek. The women would bathe in the creek, the men would bathe in the ocean part. And especially days like this where it's close to freezing, you know, not quite freezing, but very cold. I think about them out there every morning bathing in this, and I'm very thankful for my hot shower, I guess, in the morning. But, you know, they lived in this elements. There were some tough old people, and they made us who we are today.
Well, Councilmember Rio Jamie, thank you so much for explaining some of the Quileute traditions to us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now, from the rain-soaked Olympic Peninsula to much warmer climes, you know, this is the time of year when a lot of us are daydreaming about getting the heck out of this part of the country. But we're going to meet somebody who is contemplating kind of the reverse of that. So KPLU's Kevin Kniestad joins me now to tell us a little bit more about it. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Gabe.
So you talked to somebody from Hawaii who was actually jealous of the Seattle rain. What is going on with that?
Yeah, it's kind of funny, isn't it? I mean, this time of year, we're especially wanting to get to a place like Hawaii. And I talked to Amanda Frazier, who's a singer-songwriter from Hawaii. And her latest album called Just Dream won the Nahoku Hano Hano Award for Best Alternative Album for 2014, basically the equivalent of the Grammy Award. And on her album, she has a song called Seattle Rain, in which she sings about wishing she could trade places with the Seattle rain. And I asked her what her inspiration was for this song, and here's what she had to say.
So I actually wrote this song a couple of years ago. I was dating someone that was from Hawaii but was going to school in Seattle. And so it was a long-distance relationship, and knowing that it rains all the time in Seattle, you know, I wrote this song because I missed him. You know, he moved away, and I wasn't able to see him, but the rain got to see him every day, you know, as it was falling. And so I wrote the song to the rain. I'm singing to the rain in the lyrics.
So is it almost a jealousy of the rain?
Yeah, exactly. It's like I'm jealous of the rain because the rain gets to see him all the time, you know, gets to be near him, gets to touch him, gets to see him, spend time with him in a sense. So it was like a personification, you know, of the rain.
Would your boyfriend, would he complain about the rain while he was over here?
You know what? He loved it there. I think he still lives there now. We're not dating anymore, but he loved it, actually, the weather, the cold weather, and he didn't mind the rain at all.
So did that make it easier or harder that he liked the rain?
Harder. I'm like, no, come back to Hawaii.
So your song Seattle Rain, it's become quite popular among your fans, hasn't it? Especially in Hawaii. What do you hear from your listeners and your fans about that song?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, even though maybe not everyone's been to Seattle or can relate in that specific way, but I think it's people relate to the idea of someone being far away, you know, and wanting to be with them. And there's a lot of military presence here in Hawaii as well. And that feeling of someone's far away and you just wish it could be there. And it's a fun way of putting that into words.
And you brought your guitar with you today. Would you mind playing Seattle Rain for us now?
Yeah, I would love to.
Missing him. Oh yeah, yeah.
go and pack my bags and catch tomorrow's flight. You can't have him all to yourself, you know. No, that just isn't right. After all, sweet rain, all you do is keep him cold all through the night. Oh, Seattle rain. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, Seattle rain. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, Seattle rain. Oh,
Amanda Fraser, winner of the 2014 Nahoku Hanohano Award for Best Alternative Album of the Year. It's the equivalent of the Grammy Awards in Hawaii. She's singing Seattle Rain from her album Just Dream, and she talked with KPLU's Kevin Kniestad. Sound Effect is produced by Arwin Nix with Kevin Kniestad. We had contributions this week from Ed Ronco and Paula Whistle. Special thanks to Christy Barron of the Forks Forum and to Mark at Pacific Pizza in Forks, who graciously mailed us back our son's book, Captain Underpants and the Big Bad Battle of the Bionic Booger Boy. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer and Martha Kang, our online managing editor. You can get in touch and listen to stuff at kplusoundeffect.org. Next week on Sound Effect, we'll explore some of the Northwest's mythic stories and real-life legends.
Is this guy really the Green River Killer? Did he really commit all the murders that he's saying?
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.